his own brother, his kid brother, who had passed last spring from cancer of the throat that had withered him to the weight of a young girl, and who had not spoken to the old man for years, and when the old man had gone to see him in the hospital, could no longer speak, could only look, and in his eyes was exhaustion, but not so much fear, brave eyes. On a kid brother the old man had never before thought of as brave. The officer didn't have time for the old man, but he had time for his age and for his service record, and so he allowed the old man to linger nearby for a while, before saying with a polite dip of his head that it would be best if he now moved on. The old man asked the officer whether it was Mexicans that had been coming through, or was it Muslims, because he couldn't be sure, and the officer said he couldn't answer, sir. So the old man stood silent for a bit, and the officer led him, as cars were diverted and told to go some other way, and as rich neighbors who had bought their properties more recently sat at their front windows and stared, and in the end the old man asked how he could help. The old man felt like a child suddenly, asking this. The officer was young enough to be his grandson. The officer said they'd let him know, sir. I'll let you know. That's what the old man's father used to say to him when he was pestering. And in some ways the officer did look like his father, more like his father than like the old man anyway, like his father when the old man was just a boy. The officer offered to arrange for the old man to be dropped off if he wanted, with kin maybe, or friends. It was a warm early winter's day, clear and sunny. Far below, the surfers were paddling out in their wetsuits. Above the ocean, in the distance, the gray transport planes were lining up to land at Coronado. The old man wondered where he should go, and thinking about it, realized he couldn't come up with a single place. After the assault on the stock exchange of Said and Nadia City, it seemed the militants had changed strategy and grown in confidence, and instead of merely detonating a bomb here or orchestrating a shooting there, they began taking over and holding territory throughout the city. Sometimes a building, sometimes an entire neighborhood, for hours usually, but on occasion for days. How so many of them were arriving so quickly from their bastions in the hills remained a mystery, but the city was vast and sprawling and impossible to disconnect from the surrounding countryside. Besides, the militants were well known to have sympathizers within. The curfew Said's parents had been waiting for was duly imposed and enforced with hair-trigger zeal. Not just sandbag checkpoints and razor wire proliferating, but also howitzers and infantry fighting vehicles and tanks with their turrets clad in the rectangular barnacles of explosive reactive armor. Said went with his father to pray on the first Friday after the curfew's commencement, and Said prayed for peace, and Said's father prayed for Said, and the preacher in his sermon urged all the congregants to pray for the righteous to emerge victorious in the war, but carefully refrained from specifying on which side of the conflict he thought the righteous to be. Said's father felt, as he walked back to campus and his son drove back to work, that he had made a mistake with his career, that he should have done something else with his life, because then he might have had the money to send Said abroad. Perhaps he had been selfish, his notion of helping the youth and the country through teaching and research merely an expression of vanity, and a far more decent path would have been to pursue wealth at all costs. Said's mother prayed at home, newly particular about not missing a single one of her devotions, but she insisted on claiming that nothing had changed, that the city had seen similar crises before, though she could not say when, and that the local press and foreign media were exaggerating the danger. She did, however, develop difficulty sleeping, and obtained from her pharmacist, a woman she trusted not to gossip, a sedative to take secretly before bed. At Said's office, work was slow, even though three of his fellow employees had stopped showing up, and there ought to have been more to do for those who were still present. Conversations focused mainly on conspiracy theories, the status of the fighting, and how to get out of the country. And since visas, which had long been near impossible, were now truly impossible for non-wealthy people to secure, and journeys on passenger planes and ships were therefore out of the question, the relative merits, or rather risks, of the various overland routes were guessed at and picked apart again and again. At Nadia's workplace it was much the same, with the added intrigue that came from her boss and her boss's boss being among those rumored to have fled abroad, since neither had returned as scheduled from their holidays. Their offices sat empty behind glass partitions at the prow and stern of the oblong floor, an abandoned suit hanging in its dust cover on a hat rack in one, while the rows of open-plan desks between them remained largely occupied, including Nadia's, at which she was often to be seen on her phone. Nadia and Said began to meet during the day, typically for lunch at a cheap burger joint equidistant from their workplaces, with deep booths at the back that were somewhat private, and there they held hands beneath the table, and sometimes he stroked the inside of her thigh, and she placed her palm on the zipper of his trousers, but only briefly and rarely, in the gaps when it appeared waiters and fellow diners were not looking, and they tormented each other in this way, since travel between dusk and dawn was forbidden, and so they could not be alone without Said spending the entire night, which seemed to her a step well worth taking, but to him something they should delay, in part, he said, because he did not know what to tell his parents, and in part because he feared leaving them alone. Mostly they communicated by phone, a message here, a link to an article there, a shared image of one or the other of them at work or at home, before a window as the sun set or a breeze blew or a funny expression came and went. Said was certain he was in love. Nadia was not certain what exactly she was feeling, but she was certain it had force. Dramatic circumstances, such as those in which they and other new lovers in the city now found themselves, have a habit of creating dramatic emotions. And furthermore, the curfew served to conjure up an effect similar to that of a long-distance relationship. And long-distance relationships are well known for their potential to heighten passion, at least for a while, just as fasting is well known to heighten one's appreciation for food. The first 2 weekends of the curfew came and went without them meeting, outbursts of fighting, making travel first in Said's neighborhood and then in Nadia's impossible. And Said forwarded to Nadia a popular joke about the militants politely wishing to ensure that the city's population was well rested on their days off. Airstrikes were called in by the army on both occasions, shattering Said's bathroom window while he was in the shower, and shaking like an earthquake, Nadia and her lemon tree as she sat on her terrace smoking a joint. Fighter bombers grated hoarsely through the sky. But on the third weekend there was a lull, and Said went to Nadia's, and she met him in a nearby cafe, since it was too risky for her to drop a robe into the street by day, or for him to change outdoors, and so he pulled it on in the cafe's bathroom while she paid the bill, and then with his head covered and eyes on the ground, followed her into her building, and once upstairs and inside, they soon slipped into her bed and were nearly naked together, and after much pleasure, but also what she considered a bit excessive a delay on his part, she asked if he had brought a condom, and he held her face in his hands and said, "I don't think we should have sex until we're married." And she laughed and pressed close, and he shook his head, and she stopped and stared at him and said, "Are you fucking joking?" For a second, Nadia was seized by a wild fury, but then, as she looked at Said, he appeared almost lethally mortified, and a coil loosened in her, and she smiled a little, and she held him tight, to torture him and to test him, and she said, surprising herself, "It's okay. We can see." Later, as they lay in bed, listening to an old and slightly scratched Bossa Nova LP, Said showed her on his phone images by a French photographer of famous cities at night, lit only by the glow of the stars. "But how did he get everyone to turn their lights off?" Nadia asked. "He didn't," Said said. "He just removed the lighting, by computer, I think." "And he left the stars bright?" "No, above these cities you can barely see the stars, just like here. He had to go to deserted places, places with no human lights. For each city sky, he went to a deserted place that was just as far north, or south, at the same latitude, basically. The same place the city would be in a few hours, with the earth spin. And once he got there, he pointed his camera in the same direction." "So he got the same sky the city would have had, if it was completely dark?" "The same sky, but at a different time." Nadia thought about this. They were achingly beautiful, these ghostly cities. New York, Rio, Shanghai, Paris. Under their stains of stars, images as though from an epoch before electricity, but with the buildings of today. Whether they looked like the past or the present, or the future. She couldn't decide. The following week, it appeared that the government's massive show of force was succeeding. There were no major new attacks in the city. There were even rumors that the curfew might be relaxed. But one day, the signal to every mobile phone in the city simply vanished, turned off as if by flipping a switch. An announcement of the government's decision was made over television and radio, a temporary anti-terrorism measure, it was said, but with no end date given. Internet connectivity was suspended as well. Nadia did not have a landline at home. Said's landline had not worked in months. Deprived of the portals to each other and to the world provided by their mobile phones, and confined to their apartments by the nighttime curfew, Nadia and Said, and countless others, felt marooned and alone and much more afraid. Chapter 4. The evening class Said and Nadia had been taking was finished, having concluded with the arrival of the first dense smogs of winter. And in any case, the curfew meant courses such as theirs could not have continued. Neither of them had been to the other's office, so they didn't know where to reach one another during the day. And without their mobile phones and access to the internet, there was no ready way for them to reestablish contact. It was as if they were bats that had lost the use of their ears, and hence their ability to find things as they flew in the dark. The day after their phone signals died, Said went to their usual burger joint at lunchtime. But Nadia did not show, and the day after that, when he went again, the restaurant was shuttered, its owner perhaps having fled or simply disappeared. Said was aware that Nadia worked at an insurance company, and from his office he called the operator and asked for the names and numbers of insurance companies, and tried phoning them all, one by one, inquiring for her at each. This took time. The telephone company was struggling under the sudden load and also to repair infrastructure destroyed in the fighting, and so Said's office landline worked at best intermittently, and when it did, an operator could be swatted out of the swarm of busy tones only rarely, and that operator was, despite Said's desperate entreaties being common in those days, limited to giving out a maximum of two numbers per call. And when Said finally did obtain a new pair of numbers to try, more often than not, one or both proved to be non-functional on any given day, and he had to ring and ring and ring again. Nadia spent her lunch hours racing home to stock up on supplies. She bought bags of flour and rice and nuts and dried fruit and bottles of oil and cans of powdered milk and cured meat and fish in brine, all at exorbitant prices, her forearms aching from the strain of carrying them up to her apartment, one load after another. She was fond of eating vegetables, but people said the key was to have as many calories stashed away as possible, and so foods like vegetables, which were bulky for the amount of energy they could provide and also prone to spoilage, were less useful. But soon the shelves of shops near her were close to bare, even of vegetables. And when the government instituted a policy that no one person could buy more than a certain amount per day, Nadia, like many others, was both panicked and relieved. On the weekend, she went at dawn to her bank and stood in a line that was already quite long, waiting for the bank to open. But when it opened, the line became a throng, and she had no choice but to surge forward like everyone else. And there in the unruly crowd, she was groped from behind, someone pushing his hand down her buttocks and between her legs and trying to penetrate her with his finger, failing because he was outside the multiple fabrics of her robe and her jeans and her underclothes, but coming as close to succeeding as possible under the circumstances, applying incredible force as she was pinned by the bodies around her, unable to move or even raise her hands, and so stunned she could not shout or speak, reduced to clamping her thighs together and her jaws together, her mouth shutting automatically, almost physiologically, instinctively, her body sealing itself off, and then the crowd moved and the finger was gone, and not long afterwards, some bearded men separated the mob into two halves, male and female, and she stayed inside the female zone, and her turn at the teller did not come until after lunch, whereupon she took as much cash as was permitted, hiding it on her person and in her boots, and putting only a little in her bag. and she went to a money changer to convert some of it into dollars and euros, and to a jeweler to convert the remainder to a few very small coins of gold, glancing over her shoulder constantly to make sure she wasn't being followed, and then headed home, only to find a man waiting at the entrance, looking for her. And when she saw him, she steeled herself and refused to cry, even though she was bruised and frightened and furious, and the man, who had been waiting all day, was safe. She led him upstairs, forgetting that they might be seen, or not caring, and so not bothering this once with a robe for him. And upstairs she made them both tea, her hands trembling, finding it difficult to speak. She was embarrassed and angry that she was this glad to see him, and felt she might start yelling at him at any moment, and he could see how upset she was, and so he silently opened the bags he had brought and gave her a kerosene camping stove, some extra fuel, a large box of matches, 50 candles, and a packet of chlorine tablets for disinfecting water. "I couldn't find flowers," he said. She smiled at last, a half smile, and asked, "Do you have a gun?" They smoked a joint and listened to music, and after a while, Nadia tried again to make Saeed have sex with her, not because she felt particularly sexy, but because she wanted to cauterize the incident from outside the bank in her memory, and Saeed succeeded again in holding back, even as they pleasured each other, and he told her again that they should not have sex before they were married, that doing otherwise was against his beliefs. But it was not until he suggested she move in with his parents and him that she understood his words had been a kind of proposal. She stroked his hair as his head rested on her chest and asked, "Are you saying you want to get married?" "Yes." "To me?" "To anyone, really." She snorted. "Yes," he said, rising up and looking at her. "To you." She didn't say anything. "What do you think?" he asked. She felt great tenderness well up in her for him at that moment, as he waited for her reply. And she felt also a galloping terror. And she felt further something altogether more complicated, something that struck her as akin to resentment. "I don't know," she said. He kissed her. "Okay," he replied. As he was leaving, she saved his office details and he saved hers, and she gave him a black robe to wear, and she told him not to bother stashing it in the crack between her building and the next, where previously he had been hiding the robes he exited in for her to collect, but rather to hold on to it, and she gave him a set of keys too. "So my sister can let herself in next time, if she arrives before me," she explained. And both of them grinned. But when he was gone, she heard the demolition blows of distant artillery, the unmaking of buildings, large-scale fighting having resumed somewhere, and she was worried for him on his drive home. And she thought it an absurd situation that she would have to wait until she went to work the following day to discover whether he had traversed the distance to his home safely. Nadia bolted her door and laboriously pushed her sofa against it, so that it was now barricaded from within. That night, in a rooftop flat not unlike Nadia's, in a neighborhood not far from Nadia's, a brave man stood in the light of a torch built into his mobile phone and waited. He could hear, from time to time, the same artillery that Nadia could hear, though more loudly. It rattled the windows of his flat, but only in a gentle way, without any risk at present of them breaking. The brave man did not have a wristwatch or a flashlight, so his signal-less phone served both functions, and he wore a heavy winter jacket, and inside his jacket were a pistol and a knife with a blade as long as his hand. Another man had begun to emerge from a black door at the far end of the room, a door black even in the dimness, black despite the beam of the phone torch, and this second man the brave man watched from his post beside the front door, but did nothing visibly to help. The brave man merely listened to the sounds in the stairwell outside, for a lack of sound in the stairwell outside, and stood at his post and held his phone and fingered the pistol inside the pocket of his coat, observing without making any noise. The brave man was excited, though it would have been difficult to see this in the gloom and in the customary inexpressiveness of his face. He was ready to die, but he did not plan on dying. He planned on living, and he planned on doing great things while he did. The second man lay on the floor and shaded his eyes from the light and gathered his strength, a knock-off Russian assault rifle by his side. He could not see who was at the front door, just that someone was there. The brave man stood with his hand on his pistol, listening, listening. The second man got to his feet. The brave man motioned with the light of his phone, pulling the second man forward, like a needle-jawed anglerfish might, hunting in the inky depths. And when the second man was close enough to touch, the brave man opened the front door of the flat, and the second man walked through into the quietness of the stairwell. And then the brave man shut the door and stood still once again, biding his time for another. The second man joined the fighting within the hour, among many who would do so, and the battles that now commenced and raged without meaningful interruption were far more ferocious and less unequal than what had come before. War in Seyda Nadia city revealed itself to be an intimate experience. Combatants pressed close together, front lines defined at the level of the street one took to work, the school one's sister attended, the house of one's aunt's best friend, the shop where one bought cigarettes. Said's mother thought she saw a former student of hers firing with much determination and focus a machine gun mounted on the back of a pickup truck. She looked at him, and he looked at her, and he did not turn and shoot her, and so she suspected it was him, although Said's father said it meant nothing more than that she had seen a man who wished to fire in another direction. She remembered the boy as shy, with a stutter and a quick mind for mathematics, a good boy, but she could not remember his name. She wondered if it had really been him, and whether she should feel alarmed or relieved if it had. If the militants won, she supposed, it might not be entirely bad to know people on their side. Neighborhoods fell to the militants in startlingly quick succession, so that Said's mother's mental map of the place where she had spent her entire life now resembled an old quilt, with patches of government land and patches of militant land. The frayed seams between the patches were the most deadly spaces, and to be avoided at all costs. Her butcher and the man who dyed the fabrics from which she had once made her festive clothes disappeared into such gaps, their places of business shattered and covered in rubble and glass. People vanished in those days, and for the most part one never knew, at least not for a while, if they were alive or dead. Nadia passed her family's home once on purpose, not to speak with them, just to see from the outside if they were there and well. But the home she had forsaken looked deserted, with no sign of inhabitants or life. When she visited again, it was gone, unrecognizable, the building crushed by the force of a bomb that weighed as much as a compact automobile. Nadia would never be able to determine what had become of them, but she always hoped they had found a way to depart unharmed, abandoning the city to the predations of warriors on both sides who seemed content to flatten it in order to possess it. She and Said were fortunate that their homes remained for a while in government-controlled neighborhoods, and so were spared much of the worst fighting and also the retaliatory airstrikes that the army was calling in on localities thought not merely to be occupied, but disloyal. Said's boss had tears in his eyes as he told his employees that he had to shutter his business, apologizing for letting them down, and promising that there would be jobs for them all when things improved and the agency was able to reopen. He was so distraught that it seemed to those collecting their final salaries that they were in fact consoling him. All agreed he was a fine and delicate man, worryingly so, for these were not times for such men. At Nadia's office, the payroll department stopped giving out paychecks, and within days everyone stopped coming. There were no real goodbyes, or at least none that she was part of. And since the security guards were the first to melt away, a sort of calm looting, or payment in hardware, began, and people left with what they could carry. Nadia hefted two laptop computers in their carrying cases, and her floor's flat-screen TV. But in the end, she did not take the TV, because it would have been difficult to load onto her motorcycle, and passed it instead to a somber-faced colleague, who thanked her politely. One's relationship to windows now changed in the city. A window was the border through which death was possibly most likely to come. Windows could not stop even the most flagging round of ammunition. Any spot indoors with a view of the outside was a spot potentially in the crossfire. Moreover, the pane of a window could itself become shrapnel so easily, shattered by a nearby blast, and everyone had heard of someone or other who had bled out after being lacerated by shards of flying glass. Many windows were broken already, and the prudent thing would have been to remove those that remained, but it was winter, and the nights were cold, and without gas and electricity, both of which were in increasingly short supply, windows served to take some of the edge off the chill, and so people left them in place. Said and his family rearranged their furniture instead. They placed bookshelves full of books flush against the windows in their bedrooms, blocking the glass from sight, but allowing light to creep in around the edges. And they leaned Said's bed over the tall windows in their sitting room, mattress and all, upright at an angle, so that the bed's feet rested on the lintel. Said slept on 3 rugs layered on the floor, which he told his parents suited his back. Nadia taped the inside of her windows with beige packing tape, the sort normally used to seal cardboard boxes, and hammered heavy-duty rubbish bags into place over them, pounding nails into the window frames. When she had had enough electricity to charge her backup battery, she would lounge around and listen to her records in the light of a single bare bulb, the harsh sounds of the fighting muffled somewhat by her music. And she would then glance at her windows and think that they looked a bit like amorphous black works of contemporary art. The effect doors had on people altered as well. Rumors had begun to circulate of doors that could take you elsewhere, often to places far away, well removed from this death trap of a country. Some people claimed to know people who knew people who had been through such doors. A normal door, they said, could become a special door, and it could happen without warning to any door at all. Most people thought these rumors to be nonsense, the superstitions of the feeble-minded, but most people began to gaze at their own doors a little differently nonetheless. Nadia and Said, too, discussed these rumors and dismissed them, but every morning, when she woke, Nadia looked over at her front door, and at the doors to her bathroom, her closet, her terrace. Every morning, in his room, Said did much the same. All their doors remained simple doors, on-off switches, in the flow between two adjacent places, binarily either open or closed. But each of their doors, regarded thus with a twinge of irrational possibility, became partially animate as well, an object with a subtle power to mock the desires of those who desired to go far away, whispering silently from its doorframe that such dreams were the dreams of fools. Without work, there was no impediment to Said and Nadia meeting during the day except for the fighting, but that impediment was a serious one. The few remaining local channels still on the air were saying that the war was going well, but the international ones were saying that it was going badly indeed, adding to an unprecedented flow of migrants that was hitting the rich countries, who were building walls and fences and strengthening their borders, but seemingly to unsatisfactory effect. The militants had their own pirate radio station, featuring a smooth-voiced announcer with a deep and unnervingly sexy voice, who spoke slowly and deliberately, and claimed in a decelerated but almost rap-like cadence that the fall of the city was imminent. Whatever the truth, being out and about was risky, so Said and Nadia typically met at Nadia's place. Said had once more asked her to move in with him and his family, telling her that he could explain things to his parents, and she could have his room, and he would sleep in the sitting room, and they would not have to marry. They would only, out of respect for his parents, have to remain chaste in the house, and it would be safer for her, for this was no time for anyone to be alone. He had not added that it was especially unsafe for a woman to be alone, but she knew both that he thought it and that it was true, even as she parried his suggestion. He could see that the matter unsettled her, so he did not say it again, but the offer stood, and she considered it. Nadia was herself coming to acknowledge that this was no longer a city where the risks facing a young woman living independently could be thought of as manageable. And equally importantly, she worried for Said each time he drove over to see her and back again. But part of her still resisted the idea of moving in with him, with anyone for that matter, having at such great difficulty moved out in the first place, and become quite attached to her small flat, to the life, albeit often lonely, that she had built there, and also finding the idea of living as a chaste half-lover, half-sister to Said in close proximity to his parents rather bizarre. And she might have waited much longer had Said's mother not been killed. A stray heavy-caliber round passing through the windshield of her family's car and taking with it a quarter of Said's mother's head. Not while she was driving, for she had not driven in months, but while she was checking inside for an earring she thought she had misplaced. And Nadia, seeing the state Said and Said's father were in when Nadia came to their apartment for the first time, on the day of the funeral, stayed with them that night to offer what comfort and help she could, and did not spend another night in her own apartment again. Chapter 5. Funerals were smaller and more rushed affairs in those days because of the fighting. Some families had no choice but to bury their dead in a courtyard or at the sheltered margin of a road, it being impossible to reach a proper graveyard. And so impromptu burial grounds grew up, one extinguished body attracting others, in much the same way that the arrival of one squatter on a disused patch of government land can give rise to an entire slum. It was customary for a home that had suffered a bereavement to be filled with relatives and well-wishers for many days. But this practice was presently circumscribed by the dangers involved in making a journey in the city. And while people did come to see Said's father and Said, most came furtively and could not stay long. It was not the sort of occasion to ask what precisely Nadia's relationship was to the husband and son of the deceased, so no one did. But some did inquire with their glances, and their eyes followed Nadia as she moved around the apartment in her black robe, serving tea and biscuits and water, and not praying, though not ostentatiously not praying, more as if she were busy looking after people's earthly needs and might do so later. Said prayed a great deal, and so did his father, and so did their guests, and some of them wept, but Said had wept only once, when he first saw his mother's corpse and screamed, and Said's father wept only when he was alone in his room, silently, without tears, his body seized as though by a stutter or a shiver that would not let go, for his sense of loss was boundless, and his sense of the benevolence of the universe was shaken, and his wife had been his best friend. Nadia called Said's father, father, and he called her, daughter. This began when they first met, the terms seeming appropriate both to her and to him, and being acceptable forms of address between the young and the old, even when not related. And in any case, Nadia had taken one look at Said's father and felt him like a father, for he was so gentle, and evoked in her a protective caring, as if for one's own child, or for a puppy, or for a beautiful memory one knows has already commenced to fade. Nadia slept in what had been Said's room, on a pile of carpet and blankets on the floor, having refused Said's father's offer to give up his bed, and Said slept on a similar, though thinner pile in the sitting room. And Said's father slept by himself in his bedroom, a room where he had slept for most of his life, but where he could not recall the last instance he had slept alone, and which for this reason was no longer completely familiar to him. Said's father encountered each day objects that had belonged to his wife, and so would sweep his consciousness out of the current others referred to as the present, a photograph, or an earring, or a particular shawl worn on a particular occasion. And Nadia encountered each day objects that took her into Said's past, a book or a music collection or a sticker on the inside of a drawer, and evoked emotions from her own childhood, and jagged musings on the fate of her parents and her sister. And Said, for his part, was inhabiting a chamber that had been his only briefly, years ago, when relatives from afar or abroad used to come to visit, and being billeted here again, conjured up for him echoes of a better era. And so, in these several ways, these three people sharing this one apartment splashed and intersected with each other across varied and multiple streams of time. Said's neighborhood had fallen to the militants, and small-scale fighting had diminished nearby. But large bombs still dropped from the sky and exploded with an awesome power that brought to mind the might of nature itself. Said was grateful for Nadia's presence, for the way in which she altered the silences that descended on the apartment, not necessarily filling them with words, but making them less bleak in their muteness. And he was grateful, too, for her effect on his father, whose politeness, when he recalled he was in the company of a young woman, would jar him from what otherwise were interminable reveries, and would bring his attention back for a while to the here and now. Said wished Nadia had been able to meet his mother, and his mother able to meet her. Sometimes, when Said's father had gone to sleep, Said and Nadia sat together in the sitting room, their sides pressed close for connection and warmth, perhaps holding hands, at most exchanging a kiss on the cheek as a farewell before bed. And often they were silent, but often they spoke in low voices about how to escape from the city, or about the endless rumors of the doors, or about nothings, the precise color of the refrigerator, the increasingly sorry state of Said's toothbrush, the loudness of Nadia's snore when she had a cold. One evening they were huddled together in this way, under a blanket, in the flickering light of a paraffin lamp, for there was no grid electricity in their part of the city anymore, and no piped gas or water, municipal services having entirely broken down. And Said said, "It feels natural to have you here." "For me too," Nadia replied, resting her head on his shoulder. "The end of the world can be cozy at times." She laughed. "Yes, like a cave." "You smell a bit like a caveman," she added later. "And you smell like a wood fire." She looked at him and felt her body tighten, but she resisted the urge to caress. When they heard that Nadia's neighborhood had fallen to the militants as well, and that the roads between the two were mostly clear, Said and Nadia returned to her flat so she could collect some things. Nadia's building had been damaged, and parts of the wall that faced the street were gone. The backup battery shop on the ground floor had been looted, but the metal door to the stairway had not been forced, and the overall structure looked more or less sound, in need of substantial repair, certainly, but not on the verge of collapse. The plastic rubbish bags that covered Nadia's windows were still in place, except for one, which, along with the window itself, had been destroyed, and where the window had formerly been, a gash of blue sky was now visible, unusually clear and lovely, except for a thin column of smoke rising somewhere in the distance. Nadia took her record player and records and clothes and food, and her parched but possibly revivable lemon tree, and also some money and gold coins, which she had left hidden in the tree's clay pot, buried within the soil. These items she and Said loaded onto the back seat of his family's car, the top of the lemon tree sticking out of a lowered window. She did not remove the money and coins from the pot in case they were searched at a militant checkpoint on the way, which they were, but the fighters who stopped them appeared exhausted and wired, and accepted canned supplies as payment to pass. When they reached home, Said's father saw the lemon tree and smiled for what seemed like the first time in days. Together, the three of them placed it on their balcony, but quickly, because a band of armed men who looked like foreigners had begun to gather on the street below, arguing in a language they could not understand. Nadia kept her record player and records out of sight in Said's room, even after the customary mourning period for Said's mother was over, because music was forbidden by the militants, and their apartment could be searched without warning. Indeed, it had been once already, militants banging on the door in the middle of the night. And in any case, even if she had wanted to play a record, there was no electricity, not even enough to charge the apartment's backup batteries. The night the militants came, they were looking for people of a particular sect and demanded to see ID cards to check what sort of names everyone had. But fortunately for Said's father and Said and Nadia, their names were not associated with the denomination being hunted. The neighbors upstairs were not so lucky. The husband was held down while his throat was cut. The wife and daughter were hauled out and away. The dead neighbor bled through a crack in the floor, his blood appearing as a stain in the high corner of Said's sitting room, and Said and Nadia, who had heard the family's screams, went up to collect and bury him as soon as they dared, but his body was gone, presumably taken by his executioners, and his blood was already fairly dry, a patch like a painted puddle in his apartment, an uneven trail on the stairs. The following night, or perhaps the night after that, Said entered Nadia's room and they were unchaste there for the first time. A combination of horror and desire subsequently impelled him back each evening, despite his earlier resolution that they do nothing that was disrespectful to his parents. And they would touch and stroke and taste, always stopping short of sex, upon which she no longer insisted, and which they had by now found ample means to circumvent. His mother was no more, and his father seemed not to concern himself with these romantic matters, and so they proceeded in secret, and the fact that unmarried lovers, such as they, were now being made examples of and punished by death, created a semi-terrified urgency and edge to each coupling that sometimes bordered on a strange sort of ecstasy. As the militants secured the city, extinguishing the last large salience of resistance, a partial calm descended, broken by the activities of drones and aircraft that bombed from the heavens. These networked machines, for the most part, invisible, and by the public and private executions that now took place almost continuously. Bodies hanging from street lamps and billboards like a form of festive seasonal decoration. The executions moved in waves, and once a neighborhood had been purged, it could then expect a measure of respite until someone committed an infraction of some kind. Because infractions, although often alleged with a degree of randomness, were invariably punished without mercy. Said's father went each day to the home of a cousin who was like an elder brother to Said's father and his surviving siblings, and there he sat with the old men and old women and drank tea and coffee and discussed the past. And they all knew Said's mother well and had stories to relate in which she featured prominently. And while Said's father was with them, he felt not that his wife was alive, for the magnitude of her death impressed itself upon him again with every morning, but rather that he could share some small measure of her company. Said's father tarried at her grave each evening on the way home. Once as he stood there, he saw some young boys playing football, and this cheered him and reminded him of his own skill at the game when he was their age. But then he realized that they were not young boys, but teenagers, young men, and they were not playing with a ball, but with a severed head of a goat, and he thought, barbarians. But then it dawned upon him that this was the head not of a goat, but of a human being, with hair and a beard, and he wanted to believe that he was mistaken, that the light was failing and his eyes were playing tricks on him. And that is what he told himself as he tried not to look again. But something about their expressions left him in little doubt of the truth. Nadia and Said, meanwhile, had dedicated themselves single-mindedly to finding a way out of the city. And as the overland routes were widely deemed too perilous to attempt, this meant investigating the possibility of securing passage through the doors, in which most people seem now to believe, especially since any attempt to use one or keep one secret had been proclaimed by the militants to be punishable, as usual and somewhat unimaginatively, by death. And also because those with shortwave radios claimed that even the most reputable international broadcasters had acknowledged the doors existed, and indeed were being discussed by world leaders as a major global crisis. Following a tip from a friend, Said and Nadia headed out on foot at dusk. They were dressed in accordance with the rules on dress, and he was bearded in accordance with the rules on beards, and her hair was hidden in accordance with the rules on hair. But they stayed in the margins of the roads, in the shadows, as much as possible, trying not to be seen, while trying not to look like they were trying not to be seen. They passed a body hanging in the air and could hardly smell it until they were downwind, when the odor became almost unbearable. Because of the flying robots high above in the darkening sky, unseen but never far from people's minds in those days, Said walked with a slight hunch, as though cringing a tad at the thought of the bomb or missile one of them might at any moment dispatch. By contrast, because she wanted not to appear guilty, Nadia walked tall, so that if they were stopped and their ID cards were checked, and it was pointed out that her card did not list him as her husband, she would be more believable when she led the questioners home and presented the forgery that was supposedly their marriage certificate. The man they were looking for called himself an agent, though it was unclear if this was due to his specializing in travel, or to his operating in secret, or to some other reason. And they were to meet him in the labyrinthine gloom of a burnt-out shopping center, a ruin with innumerable exits and hiding places, which made Said wish he had insisted Nadia not come, and made Nadia wish they had brought a torch, or failing that, a knife. They stood, barely able to see, and waited with mounting unease. They did not hear the agent approaching, or perhaps he had been there all along, and they were startled by his voice just behind them. The agent spoke softly, almost sweetly, his whisper bringing to mind that of a poet or a psychopath. He instructed them to stand still, to not turn around. He told Nadia to uncover her head, and when she asked why, he said it was not a request. Nadia had the sense he was extremely close to her, as if he were about to touch her neck, but she could not hear his breathing. There was a small sound in the distance, and she and Said realized the agent might not be alone. Said asked where the door was and where it led to, and the agent replied that the doors were everywhere, but finding one the militants had not yet found, a door not yet guarded, that was the trick, and might take a while. The agent demanded their money, and Said gave it to him, uncertain whether they were making a down payment or being robbed. As they hurried home, Said and Nadia looked at the night sky, at the forcefulness of the stars and the moon's pockmarked brightness in the absence of electric lighting, and in the reduced pollution from fuel-starved and hence sparse traffic, and wondered where the door to which they had purchased access might take them, someplace in the mountains, or on the plains, or by the seaside. And they saw an emaciated man lying on the street who had recently expired, either from hunger or illness, for he did not appear wounded. And in their apartment, they told Said's father the potential good news, but he was oddly silent in response, and they waited for him to say something, and in the end, all he said was, "Let us hope." As the days passed, and Said and Nadia did not hear from the agent again, and increasingly questioned whether they would hear from the agent again, elsewhere, other families were on the move. One of these, a mother, father, daughter, son, emerged from the complete blackness of an interior service door. They were deep inside a vast pedestal floor, below a cluster of blonde and glass towers filled with luxury apartments and collectively named by their developer, Jumeirah Beach Residence. On a security camera, the family could be seen blinking in the sterile artificial light and recovering from their crossing. They each had a slender build, an upright posture, and dark skin, and though the feed lacked audio input, it was of sufficient resolution that lip-reading software could identify their language as Tamil. After a brief interlude, the family was picked up again by a second camera, traversing a hallway and pushing the horizontal bars that secured a heavy set of double fire-resistant doors. And as these doors opened, the brightness of Dubai's desert sunlight overwhelmed the sensitivity of the image sensor, and the four figures seemed to become thinner, insubstantial, lost in an aura of whiteness. But they were at that moment simultaneously captured on three exterior surveillance feeds. Tiny characters stumbling onto a broad sidewalk, a promenade, along a one-way boulevard, on which slowly cruised two expensive two-door automobiles, one yellow, one red, the whining of their revving engines indirectly visible in the way they startled the girl and boy. The parents held their children's hands and seemed to be at a loss as to which direction to go. Perhaps they were from a coastal village themselves and not from a city, for they gravitated towards the sea and away from the buildings, and they could be seen at multiple angles following a landscaped pathway through the sand, the parents whispering to one another from time to time, the children eyeing the mostly pale tourists lying on towels and loungers in a state of near-total undress, but in numbers far fewer than normal for the winter high season, though the children could not know this. A small quadcopter drone was hovering 50 meters above them now, too quiet to be heard, and relaying its feed to a central monitoring station, and also to two different security vehicles, one an unmarked sedan, the other a badged van with grills on its windows. And from the latter vehicle, a pair of uniformed men emerged and walked purposefully, but without undue or tourist-alarming haste, along a trajectory that would intersect with that of the Tamil-speaking family in a minute or so. During this minute, the family was also visible in the camera feeds of various tourists' selfie-taking mobile phones, and they seemed to be not so much a cohesive unit, but rather four disparate individuals, each behaving in a different way, the mother repeatedly making eye contact with the women she passed, and then immediately glancing down. The father patting his pockets and the underside of his backpack, as though checking for tears or leaks. The daughter staring at skydivers who were hurtling towards a nearby pier and pulling up at the last moment and landing at a sprint. The son testing the rubberized, jogger-friendly surface beneath his feet with each step. And then the minute ended, and they were intercepted and led away, apparently bewildered or overawed, for they held hands and did not resist or scatter or run. For their part, Said and Nadia enjoyed a degree of insulation from remote surveillance when they were indoors, owing to their lack of electricity. But even so, their home could still be searched by armed men without warning. And of course, as soon as they stepped outside, they could be seen by the lenses peering down on their city from the sky and from space, and by the eyes of militants and of informers who might be anyone, everyone. One previously private function they now had to perform in public was the emptying of their bowels. For without piped water, the toilets in Saeed and Nadia's building no longer worked. Residents had dug two deep trenches in the small courtyard in the back, one for men and one for women, separated by a heavy sheet on a clothesline. And it was there that all had to squat to relieve themselves, under the clouds, ignoring the stench, face to the ground, so that even if the act could be viewed, the identity of the actor might be kept somewhat to oneself. Nadia's lemon tree did not recover, despite repeated watering, and it sat lifeless on their balcony, clung to by a few desiccated leaves. It might seem surprising that even in such circumstances, Saeed's and Nadia's attitudes towards finding a way out were not entirely straightforward. Saeed desperately wanted to leave his city. In a sense, he always had. But in his imagination, he had thought he would leave it only temporarily, intermittently, never once and for all. And this looming potential departure was altogether different, for he doubted he would come back. And the scattering of his extended family and his circle of friends and acquaintances, forever, struck him as deeply sad, as amounting to the loss of a home, no less, of his home. Nadia was possibly even more feverishly keen to depart, and her nature was such that the prospect of something new, of change, was at its most basic level exciting to her. But she was haunted by worries too, revolving around dependence, worries that in going abroad and leaving their country, she and Sayed and Sayed's father might be at the mercy of strangers, subsistent on handouts, caged in pens like vermin. Nadia had long been, and would afterwards continue to be, more comfortable with all varieties of movement in her life than was Sayed, in whom the impulse of nostalgia was stronger, perhaps because his childhood had been more idyllic, or perhaps because this was simply his temperament. Both of them, though, whatever their misgivings, had no doubt that they would leave if given the chance. And so neither expected when a handwritten note from the agent arrived, pushed under their apartment door one morning and telling them precisely where to be at precisely what time the following afternoon, that Sayed's father would say, "You two must go, but I will not come." Sayed and Nadia said this was impossible and explained, in case of misunderstanding, that there was no problem, that they had paid the agent for 3 passages and would all be leaving together, and Sayed's father heard them out but would not be budged. They, he repeated, had to go, and he had to stay. Sayed threatened to carry his father over his shoulder if he needed to, and he had never spoken to his father in this way, and his father took him aside, for he could see the pain he was causing his son. And when Sayed asked why his father was doing this, what could possibly make him want to stay, Sayed's father said, "Your mother is here." Sayed said, "Mother is gone." His father said, "Not for me." And this was true in a way. Sayed's mother was not gone for Sayed's father, not entirely, and it would have been difficult for Sayed's father to leave the place where he had spent a life with her, difficult not to be able to visit her grave each day, and he did not wish to do this. He preferred to abide, in a sense, in the past, for the past offered more to him. But Sayed's father was thinking also of the future, even though he did not say this to Sayed, for he feared that if he said this to his son, that his son might not go, and he knew above all else that his son must go. And what he did not say was that he had come to that point in a parent's life when, if a flood arrives, one knows one must let go of one's child, contrary to all the instincts one had when one was younger, because holding on can no longer offer the child protection. It can only pull the child down and threaten them with drowning. For the child is now stronger than the parent, and the circumstances are such that the utmost of strength is required, and the arc of a child's life only appears for a while to match the arc of a parent's. In reality, one sits atop the other, a hill atop a hill, a curve atop a curve, and Sayed's father's arc now needed to curve lower, while his son's still curved higher. For with an old man hampering them, these 2 young people were simply less likely to survive. Sayed's father told his son he loved him and said that Sayed must not disobey him in this, that he had not believed in commanding his son, but in this moment he was doing so, that only death awaited Sayed and Nadia in this city, and that one day, when things were better, Sayed would come back to him. And both men knew, as this was said, that it would not happen, that Sayed would not be able to return while his father still lived. And indeed, as it transpired, Sayed would not, after this night that was just beginning, spend another night with his father again. Sayed's father then summoned Nadia into his room and spoke to her without Sayed and said that he was entrusting her with his son's life. And she, whom he called daughter, must, like a daughter, not fail him, whom she called father. And she must see Sayed through to safety. And he hoped she would one day marry his son and be called mother by his grandchildren. But this was up to them to decide. And all he asked was that she remain by Sayed's side until Sayed was out of danger. And he asked her to promise this to him. And she said she would promise only if Sayed's father came with them. And he said again that he could not, but that they must go. He said it softly, like a prayer. And she sat there with him in silence, and the minutes passed, and in the end, she promised. And it was an easy promise to make, because she had at that time